Your problems are not bigger than God. Now, that may seem real easy for me to say to a group of people living in Manhattan, Kansas. But what about citizens of Afghanistan who are watching their homeland become a territory that's ruled by a radical Islamic group? And I could point to multiple other places around the globe where people are facing similar trials, similar devastation. You know, when people see what's happening in their nation and it makes them so desperate that they decide to take their chances holding on to an airplane rather than remain in the country that they lived in. When people have good reason to believe that some basic human rights are going to be stripped away, that their very lives may be in danger, can we say to them, your problems are not bigger than God? You know, our problems here may seem small in comparison to what we could look at around the world. But it's surprisingly easy, isn't it, for us to have things happen in our lives and to react to those things in a way that makes us seem like that particular problem is something that God can't handle. Isn't it too easy for us to come to that point? You know, maybe you think it's a problem that more people are not vaccinated for COVID. Maybe you think it's a problem that too many people are vaccinated for COVID. Maybe you're concerned that people are going to be required to wear masks again. And maybe you're concerned that people aren't going to be required to wear masks. You know, these are not easy questions to deal with. These are not easy problems. I'm not trying to make light of them at all. But they're things that can stir up fear in us. And if we're not careful, they can even make us afraid of each other. And what it really comes down to is, are we going to trust God in those situations or not? And you could fill in the blank with what the problem is that you might be most tempted to think, you know what, God's really not going to be able to handle this. This is something that I've got to worry about. This is something I've got to be anxious about. This is something I have to fret about because God might not be able to really deal with this. Now, it sounds ludicrous for us to actually say that out loud, doesn't it? But isn't that the way we feel sometimes? We get stressed out. We get angry. We worry. We get afraid rather than trust God. We're going to begin our study of Exodus this morning, and we're just going to kind of dip our feet into the water of Exodus. But as we look at these verses, it's going to help us to go back and see how we get to the beginning of the book of Exodus. Because I think it's helpful to, if you think about the first five books of the Bible, they were actually originally one book called the Pentateuch. And maybe it's good to think about Genesis being chapter one. And now Exodus is chapter 2. It's a continuation of God's story. It's the continuation of how God is working in his people's lives. Genesis told us how things began, how the world began, how the nation of Israel began. And in the beginning of the book of Exodus, in these just first seven verses, it gives us some reminders of how we got there. How did the people of Israel get to the beginning of Exodus? And I want you to look with me at these verses and see three characteristics of God that I believe can help you to trust God even when you have problems that seem insurmountable in your life. And I want you to see that you can trust God because he's sovereign, because he's merciful, and because he's faithful. First of all, he's sovereign. Look at verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt. First of all, who is Israel? So we all know there's a nation called Israel. And that name comes from the biblical nation of Israel. But, you know, I think it's important to see not everyone who calls themselves a citizen of Israel today is actually a descendant of the biblical nation of Israel, but the whole nation of Israel originated in Genesis. And it came from one man. Before there was a nation of Israel, there was a man named Israel. And you can see from these verses that this man Israel had 12 sons. These 12 sons would be called the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. And as Exodus begins, we see that Israel and his sons came to Egypt, and when they first came to Egypt, there were 70 of them in that family. So the nation of Israel, when they came into Egypt, were 70 people. That was it. So how did he get there? Well, this is just kind of a real brief overview of the book of Genesis, but it starts out with creation. God spoke the universe into existence. He spoke and people were created. God created male and female, and he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But then there was the fall. Man rebelled against God. He was separated from God, and he was under a curse for his rebellion from God. Then there was this worldwide flood that people became so evil that the whole earth was flooded. And God saved Noah and his family, 8 people, saved them out of the flood in the ark. After the flood, people are scattered around the earth. And God chooses one man, Abraham, whom we read about earlier. He chose Abraham. He makes a covenant with Abraham. And he says, I'm going to make of you a great nation. And in you, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. So you got these people scattered all over the place. God picks out this one man, Abraham, and he says, I'm going to bless all of the families of the earth in you. He makes this covenant agreement with Abraham. But see, there's already a problem when God makes this promise to Abraham. Problem is, Abraham is already 75 years old, and his wife, Sarah, is 65 years old, and they don't have any children. That's why Abraham was saying, I don't have any descendants. All I've got is this servant in my household. He's going to be my heir. And God says, no, he's not the one. He's not the one who I'm going to give this covenant with. And not only were they childless when they were 65 and 75, they would remain childless for many years. After that, so long that they try to take matters into their own hands, and Abraham fathers a child through Sarah's slave, Hagar. But God says, no, he's not the child of promise. He's not the one I'm going to continue this covenant through. That son's name was Isaac. Isaac was not born until Abraham was 100 years old and Sarah was 90. And even with today's fertility treatments and everything that you can do, she would still be the world's oldest birth mother at 90 years old. Now, so Abraham finally has this descendant, Isaac, through whom God can continue this covenant, through God, so where God can fulfill his promise to Abraham through. He has a son, Isaac. And then there's a problem. Isaac gets married to Rebekah. And Rebekah can't have children. But Isaac prayed for his wife. God granted the request, and Rebekah had twins, Jacob and Esau. Now, there's quite a story between Jacob and Esau. If you want to read that, Genesis 25 through 28, I don't have time to go into all of the details there. But you've got twins. Now, who's going to be the child of promise? That's the question. Who's the one that the covenant is going to continue through? And Scripture says that God chose Jacob to be the one through whom that covenant would be continued through. Not based on anything that Jacob had ever done. That decision was made before Jacob and Esau were born. God just chose Jacob to be the one who would be the heir of that covenant. And then Jacob had an encounter with God. He wrestled with God all night. And at the end of the night, God changed his name. He changed his name from Jacob, which means deceiver, which we'll see later, Jacob definitely was, changed his name from Jacob, deceiver, to Israel, which means strives with God. So that's where the man, Israel, came from. And then he becomes the father of the nation of Israel. And so those are just a few of the high points. I mean, you read through Genesis, and there's a story after story after story of how God brings the nation of Israel to this point. And I hope that you see that apart from the miraculous intervention of God, we never get to Exodus 1:1. Apart from God's miraculous work, you know, okay, Israel, Jacob's grandmother was 90 years old when his father was born. His mother was barren, and God granted the request for her to have a child. But then it even gets more. They came to Egypt. Well, why did they come to Egypt? Well, Israel and his sons were living in the land of Canaan. That was the land that God promised to Abraham and his descendants. They were nomadic shepherds in this land. So they're in the land God promised them. So why did they travel to Egypt? Well, there was a famine in the land. Joseph was already in Egypt, and if you don't know why, we'll find out more about that here in just a minute. He was already there, but God gave Joseph revelation about the future and wisdom to know what to do so that there would be food in Egypt during the famine. Israel and the brothers who were still in the promised land, Canaan, they hear that there's food in Egypt, so they go to get food. Eventually, Joseph brings them to live in Egypt, and he provides for them in Egypt. So, Israel exists. Israel has sons. They don't die in the famine, and every step of the way, you can see the hand of God bringing them through those trials, bringing them through those problems. And I wonder for you, is there something in your life that just seems out of control? You know it's out of control, but you're tempted to see it as beyond God's control. You know you can't control it, but the way you feel, the way you think, you're tempted to think, you know, I'm not sure God can handle this. What I want you to see just from this brief survey going through the book of Genesis is that God is totally sovereign over the world he has created. There is nothing that can happen to you. There is nothing that can happen to your family. There is nothing that can happen into this world that is bigger than God. He is sovereign. He is the one who rules over the entire universe. There is no government powerful enough to thwart the purposes of God. Without going into detail, you can read through about kings in the Old Testament and how God even takes the most powerful kings. We'll even see that as we get into farther into Exodus. He takes the most powerful kings and he uses them to accomplish his purposes. There is nothing more powerful than God. There is nothing that can take away the sovereignty of God over everything he has created. And whatever problem may be tempting you to worry or be anxious or be fearful, God's bigger than that. He knows what he's doing, and he can accomplish his purposes regardless of the external influences that come into your life. There is no problem you can face that is outside of the sovereign rule of God. But what if you mess up? You know, maybe, sure, yeah, God's sovereign. I know that God can do anything he wants, but what if I blow it? What if I do something that messes up what God is trying to do in the world, or that I do something that messes up what God wants to do in my life? You know, and after all, a sovereign God who is holy and just and righteous and who sees and knows everything, that can be kind of scary, can't it? He knows what you think. He knows what you say. He knows what you've done when no one else sees it. That can be a scary proposition. When we're around other people, we can try to put our best foot forward. We can try to look good in the eyes of the people around us. But we know if there's an all-powerful, all-knowing God who is sovereign over the entire universe, I can't hide anything from him. He knows what's going on. Now, some try to deal with this problem just by saying God doesn't exist. Because if I say that God doesn't exist, or I limit what God can do, then I don't have to worry about that problem. I say, well, yeah, he doesn't really know. He doesn't really care. I just kind of just put that out of my mind. Now, others live in fear, just being afraid that God is going to drop the boom on us the next time we mess up. Yeah, I'm okay with God as long as I do what he wants me to do. But if I mess up, then I'm in trouble then. So we live in fear. We live thinking that God's just waiting for that next moment when we mess up so that he can punish us. If you believe that God is sovereign, there's something else that you have to believe. And that is that God is merciful. Let's look a little more closely at some of the people in this list. First, let's start with Jacob. I already told you his name means deceiver. So Jacob tricked his father into blessing him instead of his brother Esau. He tricked his brother into selling him the birthright that was rightfully his as the oldest child. And he sold it to, he got him to sell it to him for a bowl of stew because Esau was hungry. He tricked his brother again later on by telling his brother Esau, yeah, I'll come with you, I'll be right behind you. And then he goes a completely different way, never intending to do what he just told Esau he would do. So he married Leah, thinking it was Rachel. He got tricked by his uncle there. He thought he was marrying Rachel. He actually married Leah first, then he marries Rachel. And then he continues to have children with their two slaves. Eventually, it's a mess. You know, the flowers here are a celebration of Dick and Eva Sue's 63rd wedding anniversary. You know, that's an awesome example of what marriage should be about. Jacob and Rachel and Leah and the two slaves, not so much the ideal marriage. I mean, it's kind of a mess. There's actually not very many good examples of marriage in Genesis, if you go back and read through that. So it's a mess. You get to Reuben, the first child mentioned here. Reuben slept with Bilhah, his father's concubine. Simeon and Levi, there was this time where their full sister, Dinah, was abused by a man in the city that they were next to. And so the brothers all get together and they say, hey, let's tell them if they just become circumcised, this man can have Dinah as his wife. We'll live together and we'll live in harmony with one another. We'll take wives among each other. Well, after all the men of the city agree, they get circumcised, Simeon and Levi go and kill them all. They just kill every man in the city. Judah, he slept with his daughter-in-law. He didn't realize that the prostitute that he went to was actually his daughter-in-law, who her husband's, Judah's sons, had both died. And he seemed to be the ringleader of the brothers when they sold Joseph as a slave. That's how Joseph gets to Egypt. His own brothers sold him as a slave into Egypt. But now once Joseph gets to Egypt, God raises him up over a period of time until Joseph is the second most powerful man in all of Egypt, next to Pharaoh. He's like the prime minister of Egypt. The brothers were jealous. Joseph was prideful. Israel, the father, played favorites with his own sons. It was ugly. They wanted to kill him at first. But then rather than kill him, Judah decides, hey, let's make some money off of him, and they sell him as a slave. And so that's how Joseph gets to Egypt ahead of the rest of his family and becomes the second most powerful man in the world at the time. So here is what I want you to see as you read through these names in Exodus chapter 1. Those are the people that God miraculously brought into Egypt. That's where they started from. These are the people, according to verses 6 and 7, who increased greatly. They were fruitful. They multiplied. They grew exceedingly strong. And here's the good news. God has standards. God tells us what's right and wrong. God tells us what we need to do in order to obey him. And we should obey God's commands. And there are consequences when we don't obey God's commands. All of that is true. But we are weak and we fail. And if not for God's mercy, we could only trust God with our problems as long as we did everything right. But the truth is, God is merciful. Do you feel like you have to do everything right in order for God's favor to be on you? Do you stress yourself out because you think God's going to be good to you, but he's only going to be good to you if you do things the way he tells you to do them? That there's no room for forgiveness, that there's no room for grace. The thing that we need to remember as we look at these people, that God rescued, that God miraculously delivered, and we will see that throughout the book of Exodus, we need to remember that God was merciful to them, and he will be merciful to you. He is merciful to his people. So then let's look at these last two verses here, 6 and 7. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. So I want you to think about kind of where we're at in this situation here with the people. Joseph and his brothers died. It's been about 150 to 160 years since God promised to make Abraham a great nation, and there are 70 people. So far, that's the great nation. That's all that exists, 70 people. If you think about going back to the Civil War and thinking about how many descendants there would be from one family from the Civil War to this time, 70 is not a remarkable number. You know, a lot of couples probably have more descendants who started around the time of the Civil War than 70. But here, 150 to 160 years later, there are 70 people. And they aren't even in the land that God promised to give them. They're in a foreign land. And they're going to be there for 400 years. That's what God told Abraham way back in at the beginning of his covenant. They're going to be here for 400 years. But what I want you to see is that even though things don't look great, God is still fulfilling his promises. God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth in Genesis 1. Now, keep in mind, Genesis, Exodus, same book. The word for earth in Genesis 1, be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. And here in Exodus, what are they doing? They grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. God is fulfilling his purpose. He is working through them to fulfill what he commanded them to do and be fruitful and multiply and fill the land, fill the earth. Israel was fruitful. He increased greatly, multiplied. The land was filled with them. And in spite of all the problems from outside of God's people, God is sovereign over everything that he brought them through. In spite of all the ways that the people in the people of Israel tried to mess things up, God was still faithful. He's still faithful to fulfill his promises. God is faithful. He keeps his promises. See, God told Abraham that he would make him into a great nation, and he would do that. God told him that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through him, and he is doing that today, and he will finish and fulfill that promise. Every nation on earth will have people who are worshiping God around the throne because they have trusted in Christ for salvation, and that's how they are blessed through Abraham. See, there are going to be times of confusion. There are going to be times when we don't understand what God is doing. There are going to be times that are hard, like 400 years of slavery hard. But never, ever, even in a million years, will God ever fail to fulfill one of his promises. If God says he will do it, he will do it. And the cross is the ultimate proof of that. See, God made a promise to Abraham. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. But what's the problem? Every person of every nation has rebelled against God. We've all sinned. And we deserve the wrath of God because we've sinned against God. And a holy and just God has to punish sin. God just can't sweep that sin under the rug and say, well, let's just act like it didn't happen. No, everyone who has sinned against God deserves God's wrath. They deserve God's punishment. And that doesn't sound like much of a blessing, does it? But God said all the nations of the earth will be blessed in Abraham. But so God kept his promise to Abraham by sending his son Jesus to die on the cross. He sacrificed his own son to die in our place so that someone from this nation, someone from every nation can know Christ and be blessed by that relationship with God. See, God calls us into a covenant relationship with him, but the only way he could do that was by sending Jesus to take hell for us. Jesus died to take hell for those who would trust him and believe him to do that. He sent his son, keeping the promise that he made to Abraham thousands of years ago. See, Paul says it this way, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. See, God is sovereign. He is merciful, and he is faithful. He's faithful to keep his promises, even if it means sacrificing his own son. So what problems are in front of you today? What are the things that concern you? What are the things that make you fearful? If you go back and just look at the kind of problems people dealt with in Genesis, I just made a quick list off the top of my head this morning. Infertility, sibling rivalry, immorality, vengeance, poverty. Just some of the problems that God overcame in the book of Genesis alone. We have to admit that the way that we respond to problems reveals that we are not 100% confident that God can take care of those problems. We fret and worry and we wring our hands about what's going to happen rather than rest in the sovereign, merciful, faithful hands of God. Now, I want you to consider, why is it that we can know these things about God and still worry and still be anxious about the things going on around us? Why is it that we can know that God is merciful even to the point that he sacrificed his own son for us so that we could be forgiven? Why is it we can see that faithfulness and know that he will keep his promises and still worry? And I want to share with you that it's because that you can know that this God exists. And you can know what this God has done, but if you really want to trust God to handle your problems and you really want that change to come from within you, not just not just a thing, well, I'm just going to grit my teeth and just stand up under this, and it's going to be okay, and we'll just hold on through it. If we don't want it to be that kind of trusting God, and we want it to be a restful, peaceful, trusting God, then this merciful, sovereign, faithful God, you need to do more than just know about him. You need to love him. You won't have that kind of change unless you love God. Your affections need to be directed towards God more strongly than to your wife, your children, your parents, towards anything else in this world. Because if you love anything else more than you love God, then when that is threatened or when that is taken away, your life crumbles because what you loved most has been taken away. Jesus said it this way. He said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, Jesus doesn't want you to be hostile to the people around you. He doesn't want you to be hostile to the people who are closest to you. He's really using extreme language to say the same thing that he said to Peter three times, to ask the same question that he asked Peter three times after he was raised from the dead. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love Jesus? Do you love this sovereign, merciful, faithful God that we've been meditating on this morning? Do you love him more than anything, more than any person, more than any possession, more than even your life? Because if not, sickness looks bigger than God because it's a hardship for you, not an opportunity for God to show his strength through your weakness. If not, relationship problems look bigger than God because what you love most is either withheld or threatened to be taken away. But when you love God more than people, you're actually freed up to love those people even more. If you don't love Jesus, poverty looks bigger than God because you miss God saying, I want you to learn that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of my mouth. That's what's most important. If you don't love Jesus, persecution looks bigger than God because the pain that you and those you love experience will block out the glory that God could receive when people willingly give up their lives because of their love for him. Do you love Jesus? Now, if you're still considering whether you really believe Jesus, whether you really trust Jesus, whether this is really all true, I want to encourage you to think about who Jesus is. Think about what he did. Think about what his life was like. And then ask yourself, is there any other person or thing who is more worthy of your love than Jesus? Is there anything that's more worthy of having your highest and greatest affections than the one who gave up his life for you by dying on the cross to save you from your sin? I encourage you to think about who Jesus is and consider that question. Is there anything more worthy? And if you do believe, just as we close here, I want you to consider, what would you need to do for your love to grow? How could your love for Jesus grow? If you know what? Maybe you're admitting, yeah, I know that's where I need to be, but I'm not there yet. I believe, I love Jesus, but there's some other stuff that's hard for me to trust him with. How do I get my love to that point? Well, what would you do if you wanted to grow in a loving relationship with your spouse? or a child or a parent or a friend. I hope you would spend time with that person. You would talk with them. You would get to know them. You would spend time appreciating the things that you value in their relationship and that you have value in their character. If you want to love God more, spend time with God. Spend time meditating on His great love for you. If there was ever a part of the gospel message that should remind us that we can't do this on our own, it should be the command, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You know, like just do it. I mean, we can't do that. It's something that's got to be born in us by the Spirit of God. And it happens as we meditate and think about the love that God has shown us. John wrote, we love because He first loved us. Why? You know, if you remember the sermon from last week, probably not. Psalm 63. Why did David praise God with his lips? Because he knew that God's love was better than life. He meditated on the love of God. He thought about the love of God, and because of that, it led him to praise God with his lips. You know, there's a words of from a chorus that I used to sing years ago. I don't know how long it's been since I sang this, but I think it's words that could be helpful to you if you want to grow in your love for God. If you want your affections to increase towards God, here's a good encouragement from this chorus. Think about His love. Think about His goodness. Think about His grace that's brought us through. For as high as the heavens above, so great is the measure of our Father's love.